Chapter 2 Reacher was on his way to them because of a woman. He had spent Friday night in South Beach, Miami, in a salsa club, with a dancer from a cruise ship. The boat was Norwegian, and so was the girl. Reacher guessed she was too tall for ballet, but she was the right size for everything else. They met on the beach in the afternoon. Reacher was working on his tan. He felt better, brown. He didn't know what she was working on, but he felt her shadow fall across his face and opened his eyes to find her staring at him. Or maybe at his scars. The browner he got, the more they stood out, white and wicked and obvious. She was pale, in a black bikini. A small black bikini. He pegged her for a dancer long before she told him. It was in the way she held herself. They ended up having a late dinner together and then going out to the club. South Beach salsa wouldn't have been Reacher's first choice, but her company made it worthwhile. She was fun to be with, and she was a great dancer, obviously, full of energy. She wore him out. At 4 a.m, she took him back to her hotel, eager to wear him out some more. Her hotel was a small Art Deco place near the ocean. Clearly, the cruise line treated its people well. Certainly, it was a much more romantic destination than Reacher's own motel, and much closer. And it had cable television, which Reacher's place didn't. He woke at 8 on Saturday morning when he heard the dancer in the shower. He turned on the TV and went looking for ESPN. He wanted Friday night's American League highlights. He never found them. He clicked his way through successive channels and then stopped dead on CNN because he heard the chief of an Indiana police department say a name he knew, James Barr. The picture was of a press conference, small room, harsh light. Top of the screen was a caption that said, Courtesy, NBC. There was a banner across the bottom that said, Friday Night Massacre. The police chief said the name again, James Barr, and then he introduced a homicide detective called Emerson. Emerson looked tired. Emerson said the name for a third time, James Barr. Then, like he anticipated the exact question in Reacher's mind, he ran through a brief biography. 41 years old, local Indiana resident, U.S. Army infantry specialist from 1985 to 1991, Gulf War veteran, never married, currently unemployed. Reacher watched the screen. Emerson seemed like a concise type of a guy. He was brief, no bullshit. He finished his statement and, in response to a reporter's question, declined to specify what, if anything, James Barr had said during interrogation. Then he introduced a district attorney. This guy's name was Roden, and he wasn't concise, wasn't brief. He used plenty of bullshit. He spent 10 minutes claiming Emerson's credit for himself. Reacher knew how that worked. He had been a cop of sorts for 13 years. Cops bust their tails, and prosecutors bask in the glory. Roden said James Barr a few more times, and then said the state was maybe looking to fry him. For what? Reacher waited. A local anchor called Ann Yanny came on. She recapped the events of the night before. Sniper slaying, senseless slaughter, an automatic weapon, a parking garage, a public plaza. Commuters on their way home after a long work week. 5 dead. A suspect in custody, but a city still grieving. Reacher thought it was Yanny who was grieving. Emerson's success had cut her story short. She signed off and CNN went to political news. Reacher turned the TV off. The dancer came out of the bathroom. She was pink and fragrant and naked. She had left her towels inside. What shall we do today? She said with a wide Norwegian smile. I'm going to Indiana, Reacher said. He walked north in the heat to the Miami bus depot. Then he leafed through a greasy timetable and planned a route. It wasn't going to be an easy trip. Miami to Jacksonville would be the first leg, then Jacksonville to New Orleans, then New Orleans to St. Louis, then St. Louis to Indianapolis, then a local bus, presumably, south into the heartland. 5 separate destinations. Arrival and departure times were not, well, integrated. Beginning to end, it was going to take more than 48 hours. He was tempted to fly or rent a car, but he was short of money and he liked buses better. And he figured nothing much was going to happen on the weekend anyway. What happened on the weekend was that Rosemary Barr called her firm's investigator back. She figured Franklin would have a semi-independent point of view. She got him at home, 10 o'clock in the morning on the Sunday. "I think I should hire different lawyers," she said. Franklin said nothing. "David Chapman thinks he's guilty, doesn't he? So he's already given up?"
"I can't comment. He's one of my employers."
Now Rosemary Barr said nothing.
"How was the hospital?"
"Awful. He's in intensive care with a bunch of prison deadbeats. They've got him handcuffed to the bed. He's in a coma, for God's sake. How do they think he's going to escape?"
"What's the legal position?"
"He was arrested, but not arraigned. He's in a kind of limbo. They're assuming he wouldn't have gotten bail."
"They're probably right."
"So they claim under the circumstances it's like he actually didn't get bail. So he's theirs. He's in the system. Like a Twilight Zone."
"What would you like to happen?"
"He shouldn't be in handcuffs. And he should be in a VA hospital at least. But that won't happen until I find a lawyer who's prepared to help him."
"How do you explain all the evidence?"
"I know my brother."
"You moved out, right?"
"For other reasons, not because he's a homicidal maniac."
"He blocked off a parking space. He premeditated this thing."
"You think he's guilty too?"
"I work with what I've got, and what I've got doesn't look good."
Rosemary Barr said nothing.
"I'm sorry."
"Can you recommend another lawyer?"
"Can you make that decision? Do you have a power of attorney?"
"I think it's implied. He's in a coma. I'm his next of kin."
"How much money have you got?"
"Not much."
"How much has he got?"
"There's some equity in his house."
"It won't look good. It'll be like a kick in the teeth for the firm you work for."
"I can't worry about that."
"You could lose everything, including your job."
"I'll lose it anyway, unless I help James. If he's convicted, they'll let me go. I'll be notorious, by association and embarrassment."
"He had your sleeping pills."
"I gave them to him. He doesn't have insurance."
"Why did he need them?"
"He has trouble sleeping." Franklin said nothing. "You think he's guilty?"
"The evidence is overwhelming."
"David Chapman isn't really trying, is he?"
"You have to consider the possibility that David Chapman is right."
"Who should I call?"
"Try Helen Roden."
"Roden?"
"She's the DA's daughter."
"I don't know her."
"She's downtown. She just hung out her shingle. She's new. And she's keen."
"Is it ethical?"
"No law against it."
"It would be father against daughter."
"It was going to be Chapman, and Chapman knows Roden a lot better than his daughter does, probably. She's been away for a long time."
"Where?"
"College, law school, clerking for a judge in D.C.
"Is she any good?"
"I think she's going to be."
Rosemary Barr called Helen Roden on her office number. It was like a test. Someone new and keen should be at the office on a Sunday. Helen Roden was at the office on a Sunday. She answered the call sitting at her desk. Her desk was second-hand, and it sat proudly in a mostly empty two-room suite in the same black glass tower that had NBC as the second-floor tenant. The suite was rented cheap through one of the business subsidies that the city was throwing around like confetti. The idea was to kickstart the rejuvenated downtown area and clean up later with healthy tax revenues. Rosemary Barr didn't have to tell Helen Roden about the case, because the whole thing had happened right outside Helen Roden's new office window. Helen had seen some of it herself, and she had followed the rest on the news afterward. She had caught all of Ann Yanny's TV appearances. She recognized her from the building's lobby and the elevator.
"Will you help my brother?"
Rosemary Barr asked. Helen Roden paused. The smart answer would be, "No way." She knew that. Like, "No way, forget about it, are you out of your mind?" Two reasons. One, she knew a major clash with her father was inevitable at some point, but did she need it now? And two, she knew that a new lawyer's early cases defined her. Paths were taken that led down fixed routes. To end up as a, when all else fails, criminal defense attorney would be okay, she guessed, all things considered. But to start out by taking a case that had offended the whole city would be a marketing disaster. The shootings weren't being seen as a crime. They were being seen as an atrocity. Against humanity, against the whole community, against the rejuvenation efforts downtown, against the whole idea of being from Indiana. It was like L.A. or New York or Baltimore had come to the heartland, and to be the person who tried to excuse it or explain it away would be a fatal mistake. Like a mark of Cain, it would follow her the rest of her life.
"Can we sue the jail?"
Rosemary Barr asked.
"For letting him get hurt?"
Helen Roden paused again. Another good reason to say no. An unrealistic client.
"Maybe later," she said. "Right now, he wouldn't generate much sympathy as a plaintiff. And it's hard to prove damages if he's heading for death row anyway."
"Then I can't pay you much,"
Rosemary Barr said.
"I don't have money."
Helen Roden paused for a third time. Another good reason to say no. It was a little early in her career to be contemplating pro bono work. But. The accused deserved representation. The Bill of Rights said so. And he was innocent until proven guilty. And if the evidence was as bad as her father said it was, then the whole thing would be little more than a supervisory process. She would verify the case against him independently. Then she would advise him to plead guilty. Then she would watch his back as her father fed him through the machine. That was all. It could be seen as honest dues-paying, a constitutional chore. She hoped.
"Okay," she said.
"He's innocent,"
Rosemary Barr said.
"I'm sure of it."
"They always are," Helen Roden thought. "Okay," she said again. Then she told her new client to meet her in her office at 7 the next morning. It was like a test. A sister who really believed in her brother's innocence would show up for an early appointment. Rosemary Barr showed up right on time, at 7 o'clock on Monday morning. Franklin was there, too. He believed in Helen Roden and was prepared to defer his bills until he saw which way the wind was blowing. Helen Roden herself had already been at her desk for an hour. She had informed David Chapman of the change in representation on Sunday afternoon and had obtained the audio tape of his initial interview with James Barr. Chapman had been happy to hand it over and wash his hands. She had played the tape to herself a dozen times Sunday night and a dozen more that morning. It was all anyone had of James Barr. Maybe all anyone was ever going to get. So she had listened to it carefully, and she had drawn some early conclusions from it.
"Listen," she said.
She had the tape queued up and ready in an old-fashioned machine the size of a shoebox. She pressed play, and they all heard a hiss and breathing and room sounds, and then David Chapman's voice.
"I can't help you if you won't help yourself."
There was a long pause, full of more hiss, and then James Barr spoke.
"They got the wrong guy. They got the wrong guy,"
he said again. Then Helen watched the tape counter numbers and spooled forward to Chapman saying,
"Denying it is not an option."
Then Barr's voice came through.
"Get Jack Reacher for me."
Helen spooled onward to Chapman's question.
"Is he a doctor?"
Then there was nothing on the tape except the sound of Barr beating on the interview room door.
"Okay," Helen said. "I think he really believes he didn't do it. He claims as much. And then he gets frustrated and terminates the interview when Chapman doesn't take him seriously. That's clear, isn't it?"
"He didn't do it," Rosemary Barr said.
"I spoke with my father yesterday," Helen Roden said. "The evidence is all there, Miss Barr. He did it, I'm afraid. You need to accept that a sister maybe can't know her brother as well as she'd like, or if she once did, that he changed for some reason."
There was a long silence.
"Is your father telling you the truth about the evidence?" "He has to. We're going to see it all anyway. There's the discovery process. We're going to take depositions. There would be no sense in him bluffing at this point."
Nobody spoke.
"But we can still help your brother," Helen said in the silence. "He believes he didn't do it. I'm sure of that after listening to the tape. Therefore, he's delusional now. Or at least he was on Saturday. Therefore, perhaps he was delusional on Friday, too. How does that help him? It's still admitting he did it. The consequences will be different. If he recovers, time and treatment in an institution will be a lot better than time and no treatment in a maximum security prison.